We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Today, we'll be doing something here we do each month on the show. It's almost on a Monday. We invite questions on home maintenance issues, and it's easy to do. You just pick up the telephone, you give us a call. You got some kind of problem. You're not really quite sure how to deal with it. You call us, and our guest, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service, we'll see if he can help you out. So maybe there's something needs to be fixed. You want to change something. You're going to be doing some remodeling. Anything that has to do with a single-family home, and we talked about just everything from top to bottom and sideways, try to answer questions. So if you got a problem, give us a call, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you can also send your email questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thanks very much.
Well, thank you, David. Always a pleasure to come out here.
Something here maybe it would be good for us to mention at the beginning, and I guess this was something that caught your dad's attention, and he thought it maybe would be a good thing for us to mention. There apparently has been a very significant recall of Maytag dishwashers, 1.7 million dishwashers. And these are dishwashers that could have different nameplates on them. So we're talking about Maytag, Amana, Genair, Admiral, Magic Chef, Performa by Maytag, and Crossley, those dishwashers with plastic tubs. And they are dishwashers that were sold anywhere between February 2006 and April 2010. Big range in price. The issue here is that there's a possibility of a fire hazard with them.
Yeah, apparently there is a problem with the heating unit in the inside the tub, and with the combination of the timer and the plastic tub and the heating unit, there has been a couple of fires from them. So it's one of the things that was a supplement in the Sunday paper, and so we thought we'd bring it to attention. There is a website that you can go to at www.repair.maytag.com to see if your serial number is on there. They've got about 15 or 20 serial numbers, most of them starting with the letter N. And if you happen to look at inside your dishwasher, just inside the front door, there's a little tag on the side of the on the tub, and look and see what your serial number starts with. It's something that probably ought to be looked at. Like, say, at 1.7, I'm pretty sure that there are several in our listening area. I had the same type of issue back in the 90s, and I used to go through my inspections, and it was amazing how many of them that I did find that people had no idea that they were on a factory recall. So it is something that I would recommend you look at.
So, again, it's not every Maytag dishwasher. It's certain ones and certain others. And the easiest thing probably, again, to do would be to go to the website www.repair.maytag.com, and you can find out whether the one that you have is covered by this recall. And then there's a toll-free number that you can call if you want to get more information. But sort of the first thing you do, if you have any concern, if you have one of these dishwashers and you bought it anywhere between February 2006 and April of this year, check the serial number, and then you can find out whether it's covered or not.
Yep, that would be it.
Okay. And this is, we were talking about this, and I was talking about this with Harriet Williamson, the producer. I guess I would not have thought about the chance that the possibility that there could be a recall on something like a dishwasher or a stove or a refrigerator or, you know, what have you. But apparently there are occasionally recalls on these things. It probably, unless you really pay attention to the news or you periodically check the website of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, you may not know about it.
Yep, that is correct. And actually, I do know of one instance where there was a house fire here in our area, in the Mahomet area, that was caused by the dishwasher. Apparently, the owner turned it on and went out for a walk and came back and found the house on fire. So it is a real potential hazard and should be checked.
All right. So, again, that you can go to their website, www.repair.maytag.com, and you can check. And, again, this is if you have a Maytag, Amana, Genair, Admiral, Magic Chef, Performer by Maytag, or Crossley dishwasher with a plastic tub and that you bought it between February 2006 and April 2010, check it out. And, you know, find the serial number, and you can go to the website, and you can find out whether it was recalled or not. Okay. Something here, we got an email question, and this is something that we have certainly talked about before, but it's one of those perennial questions. Someone would like you to talk about the various types of gutter guards that are available. And the big question, of course, is always the question, well, do any of them actually work to keep the leaves out of your gutter?
Gutter guards do work to some extent, and the extent of which they work is usually proportional to the expense that they cost to a purchase. My personal opinion is that you don't want to get one that's really too good, because then it makes it almost impossible to actually clean the gutters. Yes, a better one will take longer for the gutter to fill. However, the gutter still gets some debris in there. And if you've got one that's screwed down tight, it can be a several-hour job to unhook everything to actually get in to clean the gutter. So some of the ones that will flip up or are removable, even a plastic mesh over the top will help keep most things out. The idea is, we're never going to put something on there that's going to keep the gutter clean forever. It's one of those things where we just want to minimize how many times we have to get up there. It probably is still something that should be done once a year, and some type of guard to keep out most of the larger stuff and larger debris will help substantially in keeping the gutters flowing and operating properly, so we can collect the water from the roof, get it away from the house, keep the basement and crawl space dry. It is amazing, however, how little stuff it actually takes to block up a gutter, because all it has to do is get a couple of branches or something going over the top of the opening in the gutter, then all the other stuff behind it blocks up, and you end up with just a blockage right at the opening. And so you may have just a handful of debris in the gutter, and that's enough to prevent the gutter from operating correctly. So I'm not going to go into different brands, because there are several different styles, several different brands, several different types, everything from a do-it-yourself kits to professionally installed kits. What I do recommend is that you look through them and find one that is removable fairly easily or can be lifted up so that you can actually clean the gutters when it does need to be done.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, there's a big difference in price. There, some of them are really very expensive.
Yeah, I've found some very inexpensive. I think I bought a roll of what looks like a plastic netting that's 3.5 or 4 inches wide that you just kind of tuck in there, and they're like $7 for 50 foot. Some of them, however, are $7 per foot, depending on what type of gutter guard you get and who does the installation. So there is a wide variety. Just I just stress that it is not a cure-all. Putting in a gutter guard does not mean you can forget about the gutter completely. They still need to be checked probably annually, at least if you've got a gutter guard on there, probably a little bit more often than that if you don't have.
Mm. I don't know when the last time someone came up with a new kind of gutter was. Maybe who knows how long it is. And I don't know whether there are very many different ways that you could design a gutter. And, of course, people are only going to pay so much money for them. If you came up with a really fabulous kind of gutter, but it was twice as expensive as the average, people would say, well, I'm not spending that much money on gutters.
Trust me, when you go to the home shows, there's always five or six different booths that have the better mousetrap or the better gutter system.
Yeah.
I saw one that says remove your gutters, and the water just hits these little plates and it splashes. And so instead of coming down directly at the drip line and creating a trough, it splashes and spread the water out over a wider area so it doesn't create erosion. It's like, okay, well, that's just fine and dandy if you're living in an area that has very good percolation of the soil so that the water can soak down. If you're living in an area which has a high clay content, such as Central Illinois, dumping the water anywhere within the first 2 to 3 feet of the house just ends up sitting on the surface. And if we don't have a proper drainage or proper grading away from the house, the water will tend to work towards the foundation. So, yeah, I've seen a little bit of anything and everything. But a lot of it has to do with architectural styling. Particularly here in Champaign-Urbana, we are blessed with a multitude of different architectural styles because the university brings in people from all over the place and architects from all over the place and architecture students. So we get some with nice, big, long, wide overhangs that gets the water well away. We get some with absolutely no overhang, which lets the water drip right down on top of the window and around the window. So you kind of got to look at your own application and say, okay, how is the water coming off my roof? Where is that water going? What am I doing to collect that water or prevent that water from coming towards my foundation?
Yeah. And I don't know what the average number of downspouts is or should be. I guess that that the natural inclination is to put them at the corners. You don't probably don't want to have a downspout coming down in the middle of the of a wall somewhere. But sometimes I do wonder whether more downspouts would help, or you know, maybe there would be a few times when it would rain hard enough whether having more downspouts would in fact help. But most of the time, if you just have, say, one at each corner, that's going to be enough.
Well, a lot depends on the style, again, of construction and the style of architecture. I was at a house the other day that, first of all, it was a ranch home, and I'm thinking that a riding vacuum cleaner probably would have been a necessity. This thing was about 80 feet long, and the gutter across the front, definitely two downspouts, was not going to cut it. Mm-hmm. It was going to need a minimum of four and probably six downspouts. There are a couple different styles of our, what we'll call our standard D-style gutter system. There's a 4-inch system, which is usually considered to be the residential gutter, and there is a 6-inch version, which is considered to be a commercial gutter. I believe there is an 8-inch that is more of industrial type use. I have seen things such as a house that's, you know, 65 or 70 feet long that is going to need a 6-inch gutter because a 4-inch gutter just is not going to hold enough water to get it to an area where you've got a downspout. But if you've got – most of the houses we've got around here probably don't have a gutter run of more than about 20 or 24 feet. And that, I think, you can put two downspouts in. Now, if that particular 20 or 24 foot has four different roof slopes that slope it, go into it, then we might need one or two additional ones. The idea, of course, is to put them in areas where they're not over the top of a window and where they run the water to a place that drains out and away from the house. Not only do we worry about – the moisture coming in for basements and crawl spaces, but we also worry about saturating the soil at the foundation level, particularly at the corners. If the water from the downspout doesn't have an extension, it drops within the first 3 or 4 inches of the foundation, that soil picks up a lot of moisture. The expansive clay soils will tend to expand out. When they dry again during the drier times, the soil shrinks. Well, this expansion and contraction actually results in a slight movement of the soil. When the soil expands, it doesn't have enough power to actually lift the foundation, so it just kind of moves out from underneath it. But when it dries, it shrinks away from the foundation. So the next time that some dirt and stuff blows in there, now our soil expands and it tries to move back out and away. And we can actually settle a corner or settle a foundation by keeping that downspout. I've seen a large number of porches. We're out and away from our foundation, but we're dumping the water from our porch out by the pier holding up the front deck or front porch. And now you can look at some of the older houses we've got that were 1920s, 1930s, and they've got tilted porch piers, piers that are pulled away from things because of the amount of water we're dumping in a area that has a smaller footing.
Okay. Well, questions about gutters or roofs or siding or basements or anything else. Our guest this morning is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service, and he's here monthly on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. So all you have to do if you have a question is to give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You also can email us at will-talk.com. .edu. Somebody again who was listening to this conversation and was just wondering, well, what other kinds of gutter inventions have you seen? And I'm not sure if that means just unconventional types or designs or what.
There's been several different types of gutters. There are gutters that are, they look more like a set of Venetian blinds that are supposed to dissipate the water. Well, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. It lets it run right down. I mean, it's really neat that it doesn't erode a drip edge at the bottom of the roof, but it does. Still allow the water to settle next to the foundation. There's gutterless systems where we can put in drained gravel beds where we collect the water at the ground level, let the water run off the roof, put in a tiling system or something. There's not a lot that I've come across that has really stuck in my mind is like, ooh, that's something new that everybody should have. So I kind of bypass a lot of those things because, they're fly-by-night. What works, and what doesn't, has a good salesman, so you see a few of them.
Yeah. So probably I would think that now on newer houses, the most common gutter is the seamless aluminum just because they're easy to put up. They are relatively inexpensive. You can get them in different colors, so you can try to match them to the color of your house. I mean, that's sort of the standard thing. Is there any reason to think of, though, some other kind of material for the guy?
No, actually, for a value for the foot and value for the function, the seamless aluminum gutter is probably the best value out there. I mean, yeah, there's always you could put in copper gutters, which will last a little bit longer as far as being more dent resistant, things like that. But they're much, much more expensive, and they're not going to function any better than the aluminum seamless ones that are available.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, again, questions welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Is anything in particular that you've been seeing a lot lately or you people have been asking questions about?
Air conditioning has been a big issue. We've had these really, really hot days and these really, really high heating indexes, mm-hmm. The real feel. And it's amazing how many people have been calling me and say, oh, my air conditioner just isn't keeping up. And unfortunately, because we, as a general rule, I will say, in most years, we do not have anywhere near the number of heating degree days or days when we need to turn on the cooling system, the high heat indexes that we have this year. So if you've got an air conditioner and it's been running a lot, change the filter a little bit more often because we are moving some more air through it. So instead of waiting to the end of the summer to change the filter, you may want to change one now or at least check it to make sure we're getting good airflow through it because most air conditioning systems have been needing to run almost continuously with these high heat indexes that we've been having.
Yeah. If you know, we've talked about the fact that one of the things that the air conditioning does is it also dehumidifies. And that's a big part. In fact, that's a real big part of what it does mm-hmm. because you're going to be – if the air is drier, you're going to be feeling more comfortable. Would – particularly for people who maybe, like me, have some dampness issues in their basement sometimes, would it actually help to have a dehumidifier as a sort of a supplement, even if you are running the air conditioning? Does that do anything to take some of the burden off of your central air?
Now, David, all these discussions that you and I have had, and you're telling me you have a dampness problem
in
your basement.
Yeah, I know.
Vapor moves by vapor pressure. You don't have a dampness problem in your basement. You have a dampness problem in your house. You notice it more in the basement because it's cooler, so therefore you feel it. But the humidity level in your basement and your humidity level upstairs
is the same. Okay.
Because of this vapor pressure. So you of all folks should have known that. And yes, a dehumidifier will reduce some of the load on the air conditioner, not necessarily in that the air conditioner doesn't have to run as much, but you feel more comfortable at a warmer setting. Yeah. Like I've mentioned before that in my house in particular, I have been quite comfortable in my house at a setting as high as 80 or 81 if I'm running a dehumidifier. Yeah. If I turn the dehumidifier off or when it goes on the fritz, I have turned the air conditioning system down to 77, 78 degrees to actually feel comfortable in the house to run it often enough to take the moisture. Here lately, when we've been getting evenings that run down to 70 degrees, it's been playing havoc with my humidity in my house because it's cool enough the air conditioner doesn't kick on, but the humidity level outside is still high enough that the house tends to get quite moist. So in those cases, a dehumidifier is an advantage to helping, I'd say, increase the perceived comfort level in the house.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk with somebody next to Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. Mm-hmm. Just a point about dehumidifiers. They're essentially an air conditioner anyway. They just cool the coil, and the coil makes the moisture condense and fall out, and then you drain it away. But it's essentially an air conditioner. But that's not what I was going to talk to you about. I was going to talk to you about a little speculation. As Mr. Inge knows, I build cabinets, and I've been building cabinets and kitchens and stuff for many, many years. And this last week, I went to San Francisco to be with my children. And my one son has a house, and he said, Dad, could you fix up some of the doors and stuff? So I started repairing the doors, and I came across the strangest cabinet that I've ever seen in a house. And I looked around, and this house wasn't the only one with it. This house was several houses home. When I say houses, they're essentially flats, okay, apartments. Mm-hmm. What this is, in the corner of every kitchen, the corner cabinet, you open it up, and when you look into the corner cabinet, you look outside.
That would be an interesting configuration.
Yeah. It wouldn't work here in the Midwest, but what it is, outside of each building, they have a framework on the thing, and it's set a piece of rat wire, and inside the rat wire is just regular screen wire so bugs don't get in. And inside the cabinet, which is three sides which butt up against it and seal this, are shelves, and each one of the shelves has rat wire on it to set stuff on. Do you have any idea what that would be used for?
No, I don't. I mean, obviously, it's going to allow outside air in.
Exactly.
So I don't know if you're trying to store something. Most foods don't like to be stored at outdoor temperatures, and unless you're trying to dry something.
Well, you have to understand, San Francisco never gets too hot, and it never gets too cold. It always stays, you know what, 40 to 60 most of the time, maybe 80. That's tops. They never get very hot. They never get very cold.
Well, maybe it was a potato storage bin or an onion storage bin or something like that. I don't.
I just scratched my head. I said, son, I've never seen a cabinet like this.
Well, that's a new one on myself as well.
Yeah. Oh, well, I thought maybe you might have heard of a cabinet like that for some reason, but no, you haven't. Huh? Maybe somebody on Mr. Inge's show will call in.
Well, maybe. Advice. All right. Well,
thank you.
Let's go on here. We'll go to Colfax for another call. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
I'm going to change directions a bit. I got an electrical problem in my home, and I'm not quite sure how to solve the problem. The electricians won't even look at it. I have a 56-year-old home, and it's got a 24-volt low-voltage switching system.
Made by GE.
Yeah. Who doesn't seem to want to be making these very much longer.
They've over the years, GE has come up with several different types of that 24-volt switching system. It was something that came out in the 50s as the new modern way of wiring a house. Unfortunately, it meant that instead of running a bunch of Romex standard electrical wire, you ran, I'm going to say, miles of 24-gauge bell wire. They put in most instances, they would put a relay panel somewhere near the electrical panel, and then they would run a power switch from the relay panel to the lamp. And then they would run any switch that you wanted to turn that lamp on to the relay panel via a 24-gauge bell wire. And basically what it is they ran a 24-volt system, which is the same voltage you run on your doorbell. And if you turn a switch on, it goes down to the relay and turns the relay on and turns the light on. This means you can have as many switches as you want to control one light, and up is always on and down is always off. As a matter of fact, just because I think this is fun, my father's house has one of these systems. So I am quite familiar with them, and I'm also quite familiar with the switches are getting harder and harder to find, the relays are getting harder and harder to find, and they do tend to burn out occasionally. I have had some pretty good luck getting on the internet and grabbing one of the relays and typing in the number and doing a Google search or a search on eBay, and I've been able to find the relays that we need, several of the obsolete electronics of breaker brokers and places like that do have parts and pieces for these things. So they are available.
Okay. They're available. As a matter of fact, I found a store in Peoria, but they're really proud of that part.
That's where the eBay part comes in.
Okay.
Yes, if
How
you...
about, now, first of all, they put all this great big box. It's a 16 by 16 box.
Oh, that's small.
In the attic.
Oh, okay. That probably wasn't the best planning. I was going to say the box we've got is probably 16 by almost 30.
Yeah, there's 23 relays in there.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell you which one is bad. They're not marked.
Correct.
like I said, no electrician wants to even look at it. You know, they kind of laugh at me when I say this is what I've got. What about pulling all the, just put new switches in? I don't need 10 switches for one light.
But there is no 110-volt wire from the switch to the light. All the switches have a 24-volt or a 24-gauge, 22-gauge bell wire, small, tiny copper wire, the size you'd use for a doorbell, running from the switch to the panel. So you can't put a 120-volt system in without rewiring the entire house.
All of the switches have to be completely rewired to go to the modern toggle.
Yeah, well, you can put a modern switch on it because it is a 24-volt. No, I take that back. You cannot, because it needs to be a momentary contact. When you push the top of the switch, you get a momentary contact. If you were to put a regular toggle switch on, your relay would be energized all the time, and it would burn up in no time. So it's a momentary-type contact. So, yeah, if you wanted to put
that
a...
I found that I have much more trouble now that I have put ceiling fans in, and I want my ceiling fans to be running.
Well, I mean, obviously the relay should run the ceiling fan because you've got a standard 120-volt circuit up to the lighting circuit, up to the box.
But the relay runs 24/7.
You should be able to turn the fan off with the relay.
Right, but what I'm saying is since I've put the fans in, I've lost more and more relays because the relays are actually operating. Rather than going over and shutting the fan off with a little pull chain, I leave the fan on by the switch in the wall.
Uh-huh.
And I guess the question I have after all of this frustration I have with the problem is, can we change the system to an ice cube system?
Not sure I'm familiar with that system.
That's the little plastic ice cube relays that plug into a socket?
Okay. Well, there again, you're going to run into an electrician that's not going to know much about it because those really haven't been used as much for this type of lighting circuit. And trying to get somebody that's familiar with a nice new circuit like that, that is also familiar enough with the old one to be able to convert it over, could be a little on the tricky side. So you're saying basically that your ceiling fans are drawing enough amperage that your relays are burning up.
Well, I'm saying that the relay is on 24/7. In other words, I turn the switch on, I never turn it off. I let the fan run 24/7. It's not the 120-volt side. It's the 24 volts to the relay, and the relay continues to being sucking in, so it makes contact.
And this box is in the attic where it tends to overheat.
Oh, yeah. It's 120 in the attic on these days.
Yeah. Luckily, the one we've got is down in the basement to where it stays a lot cooler. Well, I guess your key here would be to have your electrician just wire your fan systems up conventionally, which can be done by basically bypassing the existing switches and just rewire those particular circuits, the high amperage circuits.
Okay.
And you wouldn't necessarily need to rewire all the lights in the house because they're just a standard system and that what the relay is actually designed for. I don't have in front of me a tech sheet that says what kind of continuous loads that the relays are rated for. And I do know that we've got lighting systems at our property where the light stays on a regular basis, and that doesn't seem to wear it. We do have one set of lights over the kitchen that, of course, gets turned on and off more times a day than anything else. We had the problem when we painted the light switches, and that switch liked to stick, that we burned a couple of them until I figured out what was going on and was able to scrape the paint off the switch so that off the cover plate so the switch would operate more freely. And I was always able to find which one burned out by going down there and grabbing a hold of them and finding which one was warmer than the rest, which would indicate, of course, that it had been left on and buzzing. Most of the time, the relays will still work. The switching relay will still work with the switch. It's just that the power relay doesn't. So you can have somebody turning the switch on and off while you're at the box and determine which one it is that is clicking or buzzing. So there's some diagnostics can be done. I'm familiar with the system, and I feel your pain. But, if you're running into some high amperage problems, basically a fan is using a lot of current and you're leaving it on a lot, I would probably recommend having your electrician just wire those particular circuits.
Okay.
All right.
Fine. Thank you.
Very good. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Our guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is our monthly show on home maintenance, and we've been doing it for a long time. And if you have questions, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's somebody else with a question in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes?
I have a family room that's built over a crawl space. The rest of the house is on the basement. Over the past few years, I've been getting a lot of mustiness smell in that room, and I had plastic put down underneath on the crawl space. Somebody observed that the corner siding, this corner siding, which cracked, and maybe water was dripping down into the wall or something.
What kind of siding?
It's vinyl.
Okay. Vinyl siding actually is not designed to be your weather barrier. There should be something behind the vinyl siding.
Oh.
Either a house wrap or something that is sealed. So a crack in a vinyl siding is not supposed to allow water in. I won't say that is done all the time. Matter of fact, I found a lot of vinyl siding that has not got a proper seal behind it. So I can say that it is possible, but not necessarily likely.
Well, the house was built in 1970, and it doesn't have the plywood sheathing. It's got that thick black stuff that's kind of...
A homosote black board, yes.
Yeah, that doesn't look like a good stuff to use. But anyway, that's on there. The other thing there, they took out the chimney. Not the chimney, the freestanding fireplace chimney. And they just put a piece of plywood over it. And I never got around to doing anything. And I was wondering if the air from the attic would be coming down into the house and smelling. But
not usually.
I'm trying to get at is there someone... who can come into the room, into the house, and diagnose it from their experience. I don't want them to be cutting holes in anything necessarily, but I need to find out what's wrong so I can fix it.
Well, there are some air sample testing that can be done where they can take some air from that room and take some air from other rooms and then do some testing to see if there's any molds or allergens or anything that happen to be floating around in that particular room. I would look in the crawl space and make sure that the vapor barrier covers all of the soil surface.
Yep.
And if it's relatively dry in the crawl space, I would close or insulate over any crawl space ductwork, a ventilation system. It is quite often I find that somebody's put a nice vapor barrier in but then leaves the crawl space vent open. And with the air conditioning ducts run through in the crawl space, we get a lot of condensation. So we get some musty, moldy smells from the ductwork or from condensation on the ductwork. So you may want to, if it's relatively dry, you've got the grating such that we got water running away, we don't have water standing in the crawl space, I would probably take some styrofoam down there and block up your crawl space vents and see if we can reduce the amount of humid, moist air from outdoors coming in there and possibly creating your mildew issue.
Well, that's the problem I had, is that I had blocked it up, the single ventilating hole, and it seemed like after that it started to do that. And then I opened it up again. And had the plastic put over all the dirt, which was always dry. It was never been wet down there. But the air conditioning duct that goes in there, it actually goes to the garage. It's uninsulated. It's just there, the metal there.
Yeah. My guess is if by covering up your vent while without the vapor barrier, yes, you are going to get a musty smell.
Yeah.
Now that you've got the vapor barrier in, you should not be getting any moisture from the crawl space, so therefore the ventilation system can be closed off again. The dry crawl space that you experienced, if it's dry, that means that water is coming up into the house. Once you put the plastic down, I think you'll find that the soil under the plastic is always damp because there's always moisture coming up out of the ground. So the guy that tells me he has a dusty, dry crawl space, I'm saying that the only reason it's dry is because the water that's coming up is evaporating up into the house, and you're putting it in other places in the house.
Oh.
So the vapor barrier, once it's down, you can block up the ventilation. If you don't have the vapor barrier, first of all, I'd recommend putting one in, but then you would definitely need to have the ventilation without the vapor barrier. So I think what you've done is you've kind of worked things backwards. You blocked up the ventilation without putting in the vapor barrier, then you put in the vapor barrier and opened up the ventilation. So I would, with the vapor barrier in place, I would probably close up the ventilation as long as things are dry. Now, if you've got a crawl space that occasionally floods, then we may need to open and close it when we get some moisture down there. But if it's relatively dry with the plastic down, I would not have that ventilation open. I think you're going to bring in more humid air than what you're wanting, and you're going to get some moisture on the air conditioning duct.
Mm-hmm. Are there people who specialize in this kind of thing?
If
I look in the Yellow Pages, do I look?
Well, the nice part about crawl spaces is everybody that does something for money makes a different opinion and a different assessment and wants to apply their particular expertise. And some of it works and some of it doesn't. So I don't have a cure-all, without taking a look and seeing what actually looks like the problem. For the most part, it's pretty simple to do and almost a homeowner type thing. That I don't have a good recommendation that I can say, hey, call these guys.
Okay, so that the plastic's down and it's been down for a couple of years, okay. Then I can close off the hole in the foundation.
I would recommend that. Yes.
Okay. All right, I'll try that.
All right, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Let's go on here, and we'll talk next with someone in Urbana, another Urbana person here, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a question about paint on our siding. We have textured T111 siding, and we're surrounded by trees, including pine trees. And every year about this time, we get this dark, blackish stuff on the siding that I have to wash off. And I don't think it's mildew because I can take a paper towel and actually wipe it off. But I can't just hose it off. I have to actually get, you know, like one of the soapy crud cutter or one of those type of products and then, you know, clean it off, brush it off with a brush or a sponge or something like that. So it's a pretty labor-intensive project. And so we didn't know if, you know, it's the texture and the combination of the trees and the dirt from those and pollens, or if it's the paint, we need a, you know, it's a flat latex paint that's on there, if there's something we can do. So.
Okay. You did paint it, not stain it?
Yes.
Okay, it is a paint. All right. Plywood does prefer to be stained rather than painted.
Okay.
But that being said, basically we're not allowed to put the good stuff in the paint to reduce the plant growth.
Okay.
I'm going to say that it is most likely some type of mold / mildew in that it is a plant growth. Something has collected on there with the shade trees you've got, a little bit of dust and dirt on the plywood, and that type of plywood has a lot of texture to it, a lot of small areas that can hold dust and dirt, and so that combined with a little bit of moisture, it's amazing what you can get growing on there.
Okay.
It used to be that we'd put lead in the paint, and
okay.
The lead was basically an algicide, and it prevented anything from growing on it.
Okay.
Nowadays, because of things like lead and all the other materials are no longer considered to be environmentally friendly, we have more problems with the paints not being able to resist, resist the growth. There are some different types of liquids that can be sprayed on it. I know that for a while there was a company here in town that was spraying roofs to get rid of moss, basically an algicide. Where it was kind of a clear coating that they could spray on, and it would prevent the growth of any moss or algae or mildew for much longer periods of time. So there may be something that we could apply. That's something I'll have to put my father on doing a little quick research, what would work well on a paint like that.
Okay.
So you might try giving a call over to the office and see if we can't get Hank to come up with something that we might be able to apply, and I'll look into it and see if I can come up with a name brand that might work.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Very good, thank
Bye.
You. And to St. Joe for the next caller. This is line three. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah.
There's been numerous discussions regarding dehumidifiers in basements and crawl spaces and so forth this morning. And so this issue I have is sort of associated with that stuff. I have a house that was built in the late 1800s, and primarily has about 90% has crawl space, and the basement is about 10% area with the utilities, the furnace, and soft water, and so forth. And I run a dehumidifier in that area. Recently, I laid a heavy plastic on the floor as a vapor barrier, and I closed the exterior vents and placed styrofoam over the vents, plus I blocked the vents from the outside with bricks. The house is, has a brick foundation, and it's not only around the edge of the house or border, but also under the load-bearing walls. So as you crawl under the house, there's these openings in the bricks, and the bricks follow the rooms above it. So, you know when you're in the dining room and the living room, etc. And I don't know why I did it, but I thought, well, while I'm down here, I'll just close these areas. I don't want to come down here anymore. And so I put styrofoam in those openings, And I guess it was to keep mice in the area or whatever. I don't know what my reasoning was at the time, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. And then I just heard you this morning talking about the dehumidifier and so forth. And even though there's essentially no, well, very little way for that dehumidifier to cool the rest of the house, even if it had the vents open, I just wondered if I messed up by putting those styrofoam blocks between each in those openings under those rooms. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I know exactly what you're referring to. Excellent. I would not say that you messed up. I think that was unnecessary. Usually the only time we need to block things off is on the perimeter wall. We want to reduce the amount of air moving around. Leaving the individual portions of the crawl space open to each other usually is pretty good for ventilation. The only thing you might end up with those areas blocked off is you might end up with some rooms with a little bit of musty smell if you get a little bit of humidity down there. As far as your dehumidification goes, water vapor, once water evaporates and becomes a vapor, it does move through floors, doors, walls, everything except a vapor barrier, which would be a sheet of plastic or a styrofoam or something like that, piece of glass. So running the dehumidifier in that basement area is doing a nice job of dehumidifying the rest of it because that moisture will move right through mortar and move through the lumber and things like that. So your dehumidifier is functional even with your foam blocks in there.
Oh, good.
The only thing that the foam blocks would be doing is reducing airflow between the rooms. So it might take longer if you had water in one of those areas. It might take longer for that water to evaporate because we're not moving as much air past it. But, I would not say that you messed up by any means, but it probably wasn't necessary.
Yeah, okay. Okay, good. Okay, so it's good to know. Yeah, and I'll kind of keep my watching for a musty smell.
The nice part about a house of your age is, you know, when you get in at something that was built in the late 1800s or early 1900s, it has enough air gaps in it that you've got a pretty good airflow cross ventilation. Well, very few older homes like that actually have mold and mildew or moisture problems because they've got a lot of heat loss, a lot of air gaps, things like that. The brick foundation allows for movement, allows for airflow through there. Putting down the vapor barrier is a very good idea. You might want to consider putting some insulation on your exterior foundation wall.
Got the foam on there.
Okay, great, great. I would say you probably don't need the foam between the individual load-bearing walls, but I don't think it's hurting too much.
Okay, great.
All
thanks,
right.
Scott.
Thank you. We'll go to Champaign County here. Line number – oh, sorry about that. Let's get rid of that one, and we'll go to Champaign County here, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
A friend of mine who does heirloom woodworking advised me that when I was trying to replace a sash with the new pressure-treated lumber, that he had actually advises leaving some of the surface unpainted for up to a year because of all the moisture that's in. This is, again, because we're not allowed to use those chemicals that are indeed environmentally bad because lead has killed people, lead has debilitated people. So, I mean, it's a real concern, but it has to be dealt with in a way. And he said the pressure-treated lumber of the day, if you paint over that, the paint's just going to peel off right away. And he actually advises, instead of that, just leave the top surface in the front unpainted for some length of time. And then paint it next year, sort of thing. Wanted to comment on that. And the other thing, since I'm still looking at the underside of my roof here, I was wondering about whether you've installed or what do you think of these, in lieu of a skylight, these reflective tube, solar tube thingies. And the pluses and minuses and what. And I guess I'll hang up and right. I had my say there. So.
All right. Well, you brought up a couple of good points. I'll go first with the pressure-treated lumber. Pressure-treated lumber is generally the worst lumber you can buy. Usually the lumber they use for pressure-treated, most commonly for decks and some of it for outdoor use, they take from near the pith of the tree or the near the center of the tree. So it does have a faster growth rate from the center of the tree. When young trees grow faster than get larger faster than old tree. Once it gets older, the rings start getting narrower and narrower. So you do end up with a lot of this for lack of a better term, is meat in the wood that can hold moisture. And pressure treating systems are basically a bath that they run the lumber through. And so while federal standards state for dimensional lumber, we have to have a minimum moisture or maximum moisture content of 19%. There is no maximum moisture content for pressure treated lumber. So when you buy pressure treated lumber, you can just about run your finger down it and scrape water out of it. It may be 40%. And yes, if you try and seal it up with a paint, it's likely to do any number of different things. Most pressure treated lumber is unsealed. We use it for sill plates and such where we don't paint it. We use it for decking, exterior building. When you're using it on a window sill, I would probably paint the exterior exposed portions of it, but I would not paint it prior to installation. If you're using a standard lumber, a non-pressure treated lumber, then I would probably make the sill, fit it in place, then paint it, and then actually install it in place. But with the pressure treated lumber, you put the sill in and then you paint the exposed areas so that the other areas can dry. Because your friend is absolutely correct, there is a lot of water in pressure treated lumber. You can bring it into the house and let it dry for 3 or 4 months before you put it, install it in your window, but that's usually not in most people's agenda. But something to get it dried out. So I will have to agree that leaving some portion of the pressure-treated lumber unfinished is probably a good way of ensuring that it does dry properly. Now, there will be some movement, so you may have to go back after the first year and re-caulk the corners and things like that, because at the 30% or 40% moisture level of that particular board, when it does dry out, it's going to shrink. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. You can put as many nails in it as you want, and it will shrink and crack. You can put it one at either end, and it can split in the middle. So actually, you want to put it in with the fewest nails possible and still get it to hold in place to allow it to actually do some movement. As far as the sun tubes go, this is a lighting system where instead of putting in a window in the roof and building a return up to it drywall, it is a plastic dome that would be installed on the roof with a cover on the inside, and then a highly polished reflective tube that would go down through the attic and actually can move in different directions, so it doesn't even have to be directly underneath the dome on the roof. And then you put a diffuser, or basically looks like a glass cover or plastic cover, on a fixture that goes in the ceiling. They work quite well. Again, we're getting into Dad's house on a regular basis here today. We have explored this particular sun tube thing and have three different brand names in his house. One of them is in the middle of the kitchen. The kitchen is on the north side of the house, and there's an addition on the house. So there's no actual outdoor window to the house or to the kitchen. So we put this sun tube up, and we ran it to the south side of the house so it would pick up some sun, even though the kitchen's on the north side. Put this sun tube in the middle of the kitchen, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, you walk into the kitchen, you do not need to turn a light on. It's pitch black outside, and the starlight is enough that it illuminates it just about like a nightlight does. Uh-huh. In the daytime, that kitchen with no windows is just as bright as just about any place else in the house because of the amount of light coming through that. So we got creative. We found a closet that was over the top of the foyer in the basement, bottom of the stairs in the basement. We ran a sun tube from the roof down through one corner of this closet and came out in the middle of the foyer in the basement. You don't have to turn a light on to go down the basement. The sun tube is bright enough and brings enough daylight type light in there. Now, on a super bright day where we've got these great big white fluffy clouds, you can be standing in the basement and the light keeps going up and down and up and down, because every time the cloud covers it, it gets dark, a little bit darker, then you get this bright light. So you have to kind of get used to it. But I would say the sun tubes are a viable alternative to putting in an actual skylight, and probably much more energy efficient because we don't have air transfer or heat transfer because of the length of the run on the tube and the fact that it's sealed at both ends.
Okay. Well, I have an email here. I want to make sure that we get in, and I hope that you'll be able to. It sounds a little complicated, and it may be one of those deals where you'd actually have to see it, but here we go. We have someone here who says they have a 70-year-old house that appears to be sinking in an area where an addition was constructed at some point. It's caused all-season havoc with front and side door closing. Drywall near one doorway and ceiling are cracking. Baseboard is separating from tile. And she says, yesterday we discovered a gap between the bottom of a door frame and the floor. She says they actually saw daylight. I'm aware this fix is not going to be pretty or inexpensive. I found online advice suggesting that I get an analysis from a structural engineer before collecting bids from contractors. She says, that sounds reasonable. How would you proceed in this situation? Is it something that should be done before winter, or can this wait until spring?
I would say that it probably does need to be looked at by somebody who has some knowledge as to what's going on. A structural engineer, to be quite honest, most structural engineers specialize more in commercial than they do in residential. So finding somebody that's going to come out and give you an estimate on a problem like that, probably I would wait on the structural engineer until you had somebody that just had some construction background or construction knowledge, a home inspector, a contractor that you trust, somebody like that that can come out and take a look and see where the movement is. Very common to get some differential in movement between an existing home and an addition. Usually the footings are not tied together, so they are at different soil depths or different types of a foundation footing, so there can be some movement. When we have really wet years, the soil may expand and one may lift or one may shrink when it dries out, or we even get frost heave in the wintertime. All sorts of different movement can occur when you have two different footings like that. So I would say get a contractor, somebody that has some background in construction, somebody that you can trust that is not necessarily going to bid on the job so that they're not trying to do something that they're going to make money on, but somebody that can just kind of give you a general guideline, which pretty much fits the home inspector bill. Most home inspectors are capable of doing things like that. They then would be able to assert whether or not a structural engineer actually is necessary to determine why the movement is there. If it's something that needs to be researched farther.
Okay. So. Okay. Well, I hope that helps. And so any last thing you'd like to leave with folks with this time around?
Well, once again, make sure you double check. For those who came in late, there was a recall on some dishwashers, so you might want to go to the www.repair.maytag.com site and see if your dishwasher is one of the ones that needs to be serviced.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks very much.
All right. Well, thank you again, David.
Appreciate it. Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on this program once a month, always on a Monday, and we invite questions on home maintenance.